we're not here for mass production. We want to do a good product that people will pay us that little bit more for, so that we don't have to take as much out of the water, which, even though what we're doing now is highly sustainable, I'd like it to be even more. I keep telling people that I'm basically lazy. I just want to catch less fish and get more money. But good story, but that's not it. That really is that we want to produce the best there is.
This is Fish Tales, a seafood podcast. I'm John Sussman. In Tasmania, commercial fishing is more than just an important part of the state's economy. As well as a source of food and income for many coastal communities, for many, it is an intergenerational part of their family history. Stuart Ritchie has been fishing the Bass Strait waters for over 35 years, and his father, Dick, fished for 35 years before. His son, John, now manages the fishing operations to continue the family heritage.
Yeah, my name's Stuart Ritchie. I'm the managing director of Ritchie Fishing, which is a family-owned business operating out of Devonport, Tasmania, and covering probably most of Southeast Australia. I'm told I first went to sea when I was 6 weeks old, but I can't actually give you much of a description about that. That was when my father had a little trawler operating out of Narooma in New South Wales, and he also had the supply run out to the Montague Island Lighthouse. So I'm told that at 6 weeks old, I had my first run out to sea. But from about 6 years onwards, I can remember always messing about with nets and built my own nets. And then I used to fish in the Gippsland Lakes when I was very young, and eventually got a license to actually fish in the lakes. And then when we moved to Tasmania, from about 10 years on, I always had my own dinghies and my own nets and fishing gear to play around with.
World War II saw many young Australian men deployed in jobs far from their way of life and homes. The family patriarch, Dick Ritchie, working in the Australian Navy in New Guinea during the Second World War, resulted in transforming a rural farm boy into a master mariner and set him on a career on the high seas.
My father was in New Guinea before the war working for an oil company, and he was also, during the war, he was on small ships in New Guinea. And for some reason, after the war, he decided he wanted to be a fisherman. So he went to the fisheries department in Sydney and said he wanted to be a fisherman. And they told him that, well, you're going to go broke, but we've also been told that any war service veterans, we've got to give you a license if you apply. So here's your license, but don't blame us when you go broke. So from then on, his mission in life was to prove this public servant in Sydney wrong. And I think he was probably highly successful at that. So he started trawling at Narooma, New South Wales, learned how to fish there, and then moved down to Lake's Entrance in the early 50s, 1952, 53, when Lake's Entrance was just starting to build up as a Danish seine port. And he was very successful fishing. And then in about 1956, he bought an aeroplane, which he'd always wanted to fly. He joined the Air Force, but couldn't fly because he was colorblind. And I suppose that's one of the first things I remember, my father giving me this book when I was 6 years old, a book full of circles and dots, and asking me what all the circles and dots meant. Little did I know it was the Ishihara book, which is what they use for color blindness. I have no color blindness, so I could clearly see what was there. I'd tell my father, he memorized the page, went and did his color blindness test for his pilot's license, and passed with flying colors, and went flying in his little old tiger moth and found you could see all these fish from the air. And that was the start of our aerial fish spotting. And from there, that was in Lake's Entrance. And then he toddled off down to Tasmania in his tiger moth and found that this was really the home of Australian salmon. And so the business just grew from there. And we then, as my two older brothers and I got older, we became part of the business. Expanded into other fisheries as well as Australian salmon, into scallops and shark, and started doing a lot of charter work. And then in the early 2000s, I bought out the rest of the family, and my wife and I own the business, and my eldest son runs the boating and fishing side of it, and we've just gone from there.
The Eastern Bass Strait is a unique stretch of water. It's fed by the warm East Australian current and the cold Leeuwin current, which joins the Roaring Forties coming from the west of Tasmania. Because of the environmental diversity in the Eastern Bass Strait, there are many different kinds of seafood in abundance. For a multi-species fishing company like Ritchie Fishing, the diversity of both environment, weather and target catch demands that they have a unique combination of marine, weather forecasting and fishing skills.
Well, Devonport's the gateway to Tasmania, where the ferries come into Devonport daily. For us, we chose it as home base many, many years ago because it has good port facilities. The fishing grounds are about equidistant either way out of Devonport. And for us, I suppose it's a little interesting that we actually have to have good airport facilities because we use our own aircraft for fish spotting. So that was another plus for Devonport. Tasmania is a special place anyway, and Bass Strait is a special place. It can be especially awful at times in bad weather, but it is a special place. Flinders Island, of course, is in the middle of the Roaring Forties, where we get particularly things. Our fishing is in winter, and we get a lot of gales coming through there, so it's a pretty exciting place to work, and I think that's had a bit to do with narrowing down the number of boats that are actually working in that it is big boat country. And so we're working in the pristine waters of Bass Strait, really. We've got the measured to have the cleanest air in the world, and I think probably our water is much the same. We're working offshore that the scallop beds in eastern Bass Strait run down the eastern side of Flinders Island and up towards the Victorian coast. We're working in depths from the shallowest would be 25 metres out to about 60 metres. And all that eastern Bass Strait, of course, is fed by the East Australian current, which is quite a rich current. And that's why we get such a good growth rate and these really lovely, healthy, creamy scallops.
The habitat, weather and water conditions of the eastern Bass Strait produces a unique scallop. The scallops which live there need to be strong and healthy, swimming and eating voraciously just to survive. Traditional dredging causes the scallops to stress and drown, often with a gut full of mud. The Ritchies have developed a form of scallop fishing which is both more environmentally suitable and produces a far superior quality eating scallop. Whilst this format reduces the harvest by over 50%, the quality of the Ritchies catch is exponentially better in keeping the scallops live and in best condition.
Scallops, we started off in the boom times in Lakes Entrance when it first started there in the late 60s, early 70s. And again, it was massively overfished. There was 120 boats all competing there. After that, when we were in Tasmania, we were in the Tasmanian scallop fishery, and then there was a Commonwealth scallop fishery and the Victorian one. We've got licences and quota for all of those, but in that time, we've seen the fleet shrink from 120 down to about 8 boats. There's 8 dedicated boats now who are set up for it, have really good handling equipment, are able to chill the catch the minute it comes on board, and can work directly to their processor so that we're landing the perfect product. We can control the cold chain from the second the fish hit the boat until they're processed and going out to the consumer. So things have changed hugely from a boom and bust fishery to one that is now very well managed and with very few participants in it. And we've had to buy up quota from all these 120 boats that have gone. The boats that have stayed have continually kept up buying quota and licences so that the fishery is now probably one of the most sustainable ones around. We've gone from being the most unsustainable to one of the best ones. We do a lot for the domestic market. We're going into Sydney now. We have been exporting in the past. We exported to Thailand for quite a while for reprocessing when we couldn't get enough labour here to process. We were doing some into Vietnam, but our preference is to do as much as we can within Australia, within the domestic market.
The Australian salmon, or Eripus truta, is a streamlined fish with a long and slender body. That is where the similarity to the Atlantic salmon ends. Australian salmon are an underutilised migratory species more closely related to the herring and are not especially well regarded by chefs or consumers. As supply of great quality, local, sustainable, wild fish becomes more scarce, perhaps the time is nigh for the Australian salmon to find its place as a tasty, nutritious and great value seafood for humans rather than lobsters.
Australian salmon is a native to Australia, as the name suggests. It's actually a perch and no relation whatsoever to the Atlantic salmon that are farmed, and probably a lot stronger taste and not such a good table fish as Atlantic salmon. We started catching it in 1956. They're what's known as a pelagic fish. They are along the pretty much along the shoreline, and we spot them from the air. And at times, we might stalk a patch of fish for weeks and weeks on end before we go and catch it. In that, when we catch it, if we can just take that entire school of fish out of existence without losing any, and this all sounds all back to front, but if we can do that next year, in around about the same time and in the same place, there'll be the school come back there again. And that's why we've been so successful. We're the only ones who do it to this scale in Tasmania. We basically managed it ourselves, and we're just so careful about what we do. We don't want any scared fish, ones that have been in the net and escaped, because they will then just spook everything else in the area. So we're very conservative in what we do. We only operate in really good weather conditions, so we know we're not going to have a mess up. And then our aim is to take the entire patch, and then we'll come back next year and do the same thing again. And we've been doing this for nearly 70 years, so we're obviously doing something right. And capture method is beach seining, where you're actually hauling most of the net up onto a beach, and the salmon go into a big cod end or a big bag in the middle of the net. That's disconnected out in deeper water and then just towed further out to sea, so we can get alongside the mothership and the bigger boat, and then they are railed aboard. They're still alive, totally alive, and they come aboard in a big dip net and go straight into refrigerated seawater that's at 0 degrees, and that gives them an instant chill and makes them bring up anything that's in their stomach, and excess blood all comes out of them then. So we start that chilling the second they come on the boat. Then we change the water a couple of times with more chilled seawater, and then we just hold them at 0 degrees. So they're not frozen solid, but they're just chilled, and they've already had the blood taken out of them, and that then gives us sort of up to 8 days to do something with them. We like to do it within 3 or 4 days to keep them super fresh, and just very careful of the way we handle them. And the boats we have been designed and built around handling large quantities of Australian salmon. Well, the very sad thing about this, we actually get more money selling them for rock lobster bait than we do for human consumption, which is really sad. We did have some markets lined up in China, but, of course, the way things are, that's all gone by the wayside. But Australian salmon is one of the fisheries, or the fish that I think, and I know, John, you've identified as a great future as an underutilised species, where properly handled, they are very palatable, they smoke beautifully, and I think that over time we're going to see more and more of these on the menu.
Another of the seasonal species caught by the Richies is the gould or arrowed squid. More often found crumbed in a takeaway box than on a plate in a fine dining restaurant, this is another species which has a great scope in more sophisticated markets.
It is another one of the underutilised ones. We recognised in 1998 that there was probably people squid fishing, but we'd heard of that the Japanese had invented some better gear. So at that time, I went to Japan. It took a week before they'd show there's a group of us went. A week before they'd actually show us the really good gear, which was fully computerized, interfaced with the other electronics on the boat, and really caught the fish itself. Worked out what depth it was catching fish at, followed the bottom contours, it allowed for the roll of the boat. So we were really impressed with that, and it really didn't come down to price. It came down to whether the manufacturer actually liked you or not. And on the last day I was there, just before I was to fly out, I was called into the president's office, and through an interpreter told that, yes, the president's like you, and he will sell you a set of gear, and you need to know that this is the first time this equipment has ever been allowed outside of Japan. So that was a bit of a pat on the back. And when we got home, we found out what the bill was going to be, but it was worth every penny of it. And again, when we did that, we wanted to move away from the way squid fishing had been, where the boats would go out at night, they'd land them on the deck during the night and then race in next morning and unload. And the quality just wasn't there. If we were going to do it, we wanted to do it properly. So we then started freezing on board so that, again, we could have the chilling process starting within 5 minutes of the squid landing on the boat. And when we did unload, it was a frozen product that was absolutely perfect. So that's where we've gone with a lot of our stuff. We're looking for perfection all the time. And the only way to get real perfection is to be able to freeze it very quickly on board. Or if you can't freeze it quickly on board, to maintain that cold chain from the minute it hits the deck, maintain the cold chain right through while it's on the boat, while it's being unloaded, while it's being transported, so that it's in a perfect condition when it comes to processing time.
As with the use of any natural resource, the community sets a high bar, especially for the behaviour of commercial fishers. The shared use of fisheries in terms of environmental, social and economic outcomes is a delicate balancing act. The responsibility for maintaining the conditions of our waters and the health of the fish stocks often means that fishers need to be versatile and flexible in their activities.
We have our set things that we do at different times of the year. So at the moment, July through to November, we'll be scalloping. After that, it will either be squid or salmon. And then interspersed with that is we do charter work for not people going out to catch a handful of fish, but scientific charter work for the likes of the Institute of Marine Antarctic Studies, for CSIRO and people like that. So certainly our crew and John, my son, love doing that because it's different than fishing. But I always look at it as we're also passing on our knowledge as well as learning from the scientists on board, particularly when we're doing scallop surveys and egg production surveys, that we're passing on the anecdotal knowledge that we've picked up while we're talking with the scientists who are on there doing it. And between the anecdotal evidence from the industry and the scientists linking it together, we're getting a greater understanding, firstly, of each other, but secondly, of the industries that we operate in. We're just learning from them all the time.
The pressures of operating a family business are many and varied. Within the seafood industry, many families have exited as the luxuries of middle class take hold of what is a dangerous and varied job, with many sons and daughters choosing a comfortable life in law or technology over the windswept, freezing conditions of fishing. The Ritchie family are an exception. Driven by innovation and never-ending pursuit for excellence, the next generation of Ritchie fishermen have taken to building the family business in a sustainable, profitable way.
Family business like ours, we're on the cusp. Are we big enough, or are we going to get taken over, or are we just a nice size where we can remain a family business and concentrate purely on getting a really good product? I hope that we're the latter, where we're big enough to survive and continue doing what we're doing, continually trying to be at the forefront of what we do and continually just produce that really good product that we're not here for mass production. We want to do a good product that people will pay us that little bit more for so that we don't have to take as much out of the water, which even though what we're doing now is highly sustainable, I'd like it to be even more. I keep telling people that I'm basically lazy. I just want to catch less fish and get more money. But and good story, but that's not it. That really is that we want to produce the best there is. All of our fisheries are in a really, particularly everything we're in, is in a really good shape. Australian fisheries in general are in very good shape compared to the rest of the world. So the future is bright. We're never going to be a huge fishing nation, but we've got good sustainable fisheries such as our rock lobster, abalone, scallops and so on. But we've also got some great opportunities with our Australian salmon, with sardines, pilchards, all the underutilised species. I think they're the exciting ones to come yet because there's so much room for development there.
Stuart Ritchie is a true leader in the Australian seafood industry. With a commitment not only to his family business and the fisheries they are directly involved in, he has long participated in setting the agenda for the industry.
The industry's been my life. I still enjoy it. I don't enjoy going to sea that much anymore. I've still got all my skipper's tickets and everything else. But when you get to my age, you start thinking, well, if I'm steaming 14, 16 hours to a fishing ground, that's 14 or 16 hours I just wasted. I love all the fishing bit, but I don't like the time I waste getting there and back. So I'm more involved on the management side of things now. I do all the marketing. I'm involved on a couple of management advisory committees. I do a few other things with the government. So, but I still get a real buzz just going down the wharf and talking to fishermen. It's always been my life and I enjoy it. And I'm now in a position with some of the other things I do where I'm accepted by someone in the industry who's been there, done that. And even though some people might like me, I've got the credibility because I have been there and done it.
As a long-time fisher and a keen steward of the seafood industry, Stu Ritchie is setting the industry on a great course for a sustainable and secure future. This is Fish Tales, a seafood podcast. A Deep in the Weeds production, I'm John Sussman. Follow us on Instagram at Fish Tales Seafood Podcast or email us at fishtalespodcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay tuned for more tales from beneath the surface of the seafood world every Friday on your podcast app.